episode 55 of the Book Exchange podcast is here. And I'm here with my co-host, Jude Joseph Lovell. I think you're here.
I am. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Excellent. So we are back for episode 55. Pretty exciting, Jude, at least for us, because we're kicking off a new sort of, we call it an occasional series here, which means just a type of podcast episode that we may come back to from time to time. A new series kicking off tonight, and Jude, as the Somali-born rapper Kanan once said, I hope you have your passports, because we're going to be, in this series, we're going to be traveling around the world, at least virtually. It'd be nice if we could go to all these places that we're going to talk about. But yeah, alas, that's probably not going to happen in our lifetimes. But we're kicking off a series. We talked about it before for regular listeners. It's called Read Around the World, and wherein, you know, every time we do an episode like this, we're going to pick a different part of the world. It might be just a single country. It might be a region. And we're just going to talk about books and writers from that part of the world. And in so doing, you know, kind of explore the culture there. Yeah, at least touch on, you know, what writers have been or are prominent there that a lot of people have read, and just kind of share some of our own experiences in reading from literature from that part of the world. So, and that can get, as you know, Jude, because, you know, this is just an extension of the discussion we've been having for decades, as we always say. You know, we've talked about writers and books from many different parts of the world, and obviously, each region, each country, each culture brings, you know, something new and something different and something unique. And we aim to explore that with this series. So without further ado, this is our first episode in this series. And for whatever reason, just kind of a random pick, we decided to start way, way down south, area they call Down Under. And we're going to talk about literature from Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. So that is our show for today, and I don't know if you have any comments about that, Jude, but it's exciting to be getting a new series started here.
Yeah, no, I would just say kind of in a broad way, like, you know, it's an idea we've been discussing for a while, and it's something that in practice we've been doing, you know, for many decades, like you're sort of getting at, and in most cases we haven't, I mean, you know, future episodes, we may have some experience with the place, but, you know, more likely we're going to be talking about places that we haven't been to. And it's a discussion about what we know about those places through reading the books that we're going to be talking about. So it's like kind of demonstrative of, you know, how books can kind of take you on a metaphorical or like, you know, imaginative journey to other places. And it's going to be all about what we've learned about those places through those journeys. So there's going to be a lot to say. We definitely can't claim to be experts in any way on most of these regions, and especially not on, you know, Australia, New Zealand. You know, I don't think I'm getting there, like you said. But it's really exciting to do this series, and, like, you know, because you and I have been having these conversations anyway. And it's fun to kick it off. And like, you know, with Australia, New Zealand, it's like, go big or go home, John. You know, so we just decided to go all the way to, like, the far ends of the earth. And we got a good discussion coming up.
Yeah. And as we'll discuss at length, you know, in this episode, that for whatever reason, maybe it's just a personal thing. I personally find that there, you know, once you take the lid off the pot, you know, metaphorically speaking, you know, there are so many interesting writers that have been writing from that part of the world or are writing. And it's just a fascinating area of the world, which we'll get into in a minute. But I'm glad you brought that up in the beginning here, because starting this series, of course, as with all things with this show, we don't claim any sort of formal expertise at all. As you said, most of these countries or regions are going to be, we're not familiar with personally in terms of having been there and know all the back roads, know the culture, but that's, you know, this show has always been about exploration in a way, intellectual exploration for sure. And so this is just an extension of that. And you also reminded me, there used to be, back in another part of my life, there used to be a used bookstore that I would go to every once in a while, and it was called, Always thought this was a great title for a used bookstore. It was called The Armchair Traveler. And, you know, and the whole point was what we just discussed. It's like, if you can't, you may never get there physically, but you can certainly pick up a book and read about a certain area and, you know, travel. This is probably, you know, neither of us are that widely traveled. We may not get to be in this lifetime, but reading is one way to travel virtually. So, like, that's what this is all about. Excited to kick this off. I don't think there's anything else to say. We're just going to do go ahead. You got something?
Can I make one? Yeah, I want to make one more comment because you're just listening to you, so it allows me to say this. It's elementary, John, but like the thing about this series is also like, you know, and it's kind of obvious, but like we want to go there. Like the appetite is in the two of us to literally go to these places. We don't think we're going to necessarily have the opportunity, but like in all the places we're going to discuss in these episodes, like there's a strong appetite in us to visit. And if we have to do it in the pages of a book, that's what we're doing. So that's just part of it. Like I really would want, I would be dying to go to Australia, New Zealand, and we would not be having the discussion or choosing to do an episode on a certain place if we didn't have the appetite to read about that place in the first place. So I know that's like obvious, but like, you know, I'm just pointing it out. That's like, yeah, there's a real appetite, I think, in both of us. And even if you talk specifically about Australia and New Zealand, there's a lot of fascination on both of our parts about those places. And the more we read about them, it doesn't get any less, I would venture to say.
No, it certainly doesn't. And of course, you're right. I mean, that part of the world in particular would be pretty high on my list of, you know, dream vacation spots or places I'd like to visit and explore. My wife was lucky enough to have spent a little bit of time in Australia and a number of weeks in New Zealand. So I've always been jealous of her about that, but she's much more better traveled than I am anyway, just because of, you know, she has at least one parent from another part of the world. But anyway, so that is our show for today. Episode 55, excited to get into it. Without further ado, we're going to do what we always do, which is to kick things off. We're going to talk about what we've been reading, and it might be a short discussion because I know in my case, I'll just start quickly here, Jude, because I'm not going to say a lot. I know in my case, what I've been reading has been in preparation for this show. I've been going back and rereading a couple books that I knew I would want to discuss in this episode, as well as I read at least one book that I'll bring up later that I read for the first time. So my reading over the last couple weeks, certainly since the last episode, has almost entirely been, you know, Australian or writers from Australia, Tasmania or New Zealand. So I don't want to necessarily get into any of those books right now because they're going to come up later. So is that the case for you?
Not entirely. So I didn't reread anything. I only read one book I really wanted to read in preparation for this episode. It's a book that we're going to be talking about, I think, at some length in a few minutes here. But it was one that you read, I'll just say up front, you read it years ago and have been talking about it kind of almost ever since, you know, off and on.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to fit this book in, so we'll bring that book up later, but I managed to get through it. And now I just have to plug my own little series. My own little promo here is that I decided to, you know, we're such dorks that we do little series like individually. So I decided to do like kind of a trilogy, which I'm calling the, now I can't even remember it. I can't remember my snappy title for it. Gosh, it's disappointing. But it's a
it's your own series, and you can't remember it. But
I know, you know, this is horrible. But it's a trilogy of I would say deuces. So it's like that's not what I called it. I had a better title. But it's so I'm reading three books that are the second books in a series of books. You know, and in two cases it's trilogies, but in one case it's more than three books. So I'm on the first of that little trilogy that I wanted to read. And I happen to be reading a novel called Authority, which is the second book in a relatively recent and famous trilogy of, gosh, I don't even know how to explain it, like sort of quasi-echo sci-fi mystery thriller novels that composed something called the Southern Reach Trilogy that was written by kind of a master of his own genre, like sort of weird fiction, a guy named Jeff Vandermeer, who's pretty well known for writing kind of bizarre-ish, quasi-futuristic sci-fi books. And he wrote this rather famous trilogy now called Southern Reach Trilogy. First novel was called Annihilation. That was made into a well-known film by Alex Garland with Natalie Portman. It's kind of a really interesting and very enigmatic movie. But there's actually three novels, and the second one is called Authority, and it's, you know, I don't have to get into it, but it's about this location along the southern coast of the United States that's known as Area X, at some point in an alternate future that has been cordoned off by the government because some kind of happening has taken place there where it's been taken over by something that could be aliens or it could be government experience gone wrong or whatever. And it's this cordoned off area that they're publicly calling an environmental disaster, but actually just really weird stuff is going on in there and they don't know exactly what it is. And anyway, this trilogy of novels is about government and scientific explorations of that area and the weird stuff that happens to the people that go in to Area X. And I'm on the second book. So that's what I'm reading right now. It's called Authority. So it's pretty wild so far and it's really bizarre and I don't know where it's going.
Well, that's pretty strange, actually, because we happen to be recording on a night where there's some kind of ecological or environmental event happening, unfortunately.
True.
Pretty relatively close to us, which is, well, not really by, as a crow flies, but these wildfires up in northern Canada and the smoke has drifted down. We're on the eastern seaboard, or at least I am, and you're in Pennsylvania, but you're actually closer to the fires than I am, so... As a lot of people, most people around the world will know by now that the east coast of the United States, really kind of the east half of the United States, is being, you know, it's kind of covered in this hazy, you know, unhealthy cloud because of these enormous fires. So that's really strange. You know, we're kind of living amidst some kind of environmental hazard right now as you're reading that book. We hope everyone is staying safe out there, by the way. Another note, this is totally off the subject entirely, dude, but you know, little peek behind the curtain, as you know, I have four children, and I have three sons who are, you know, young adults or teenagers. The last of my sons just got back from college, so we have all four children in the house right now, and they're doing something semi-violent involving a hacky sack downstairs right now. So I'm hearing these like whoops and hollers, and you know, they're all excited to be back together again with my daughter as well. So if I don't know if that's going to come through, so if anybody hears like a din in the background, I apologize for that, but my kids are just enjoying being together, and so that's cool.
You know, controlled chaos at both level homes, it's kind of the SOP, John.
It is. And, you know, we're blessed to know each other's kids quite well. So that makes this even more fun. It's a family affair here on the Book Exchange. But, we've talked about what we're reading. I haven't yet, but we're going to get into it as we get into the show proper. So I think we can just go dive right into it, Jude. And there's no real, unless you have anything else you need to add.
No, I'm good. I'll lay off mentioning the email address. We can just dive right in. We got a lot of metaphoric ground to cover to even get where we're going.
Yeah, but I will say again, you know, if you enjoy the show, it's not hard to like just give us a couple clicks on Spotify, give us a 5-star review or 4-star review. That would be cool. Or if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts or Google or however, if there's a way to rate us, that would be really cool. If you would do that, we would appreciate it. That would be a favor to us. But without further ado, we're going to dive into our episode about, you know, read around the world, Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. We add that in on purpose because there's at least two books that we're going to discuss, I think, that are set in Australia. But the way I wanted to kick it off, and I told you this as we were kind of preparing for this, but, you know, if you look at a list of well-known writers from any region, you're going to get, you know, a whole cornucopia of writers, and there are a lot of writers from this region, you know, it has to be subjective. We have to be able to discuss books that we've read. And so we're going to do that. But in doing that, you know, there are some great writers that unfortunately we're not going to get too far into just because we haven't read enough of their material. So I thought I would bring up a couple of those. You know, you and I talked about this in terms of Australia's literary history. There's only one Nobel laureate from that has ever hailed from Australia, New Zealand, or Tasmania. And that's a writer by the name of Patrick White. I think you're going to bring him up later, so we're not going to get into him right now. But there's no way I could, you know, kick this episode off without at least mentioning his work. He's the sole Nobel Prize winner in literature from Australia. He has mm-hmm. many well-known books, but kind of, I would say, not out of favor, but just his sort of like not really well-known anymore. I think he was maybe a prominent writer in the 50s and 60s and maybe 70s. I personally have read one book by him that was called The Tree of Man. I think he wrote it in the early 70s. It was a long, kind of slow-moving, you know, history of a family that set up a farm and kind of a homestead in Australia. And it was sort of basically a chronicle of a rural family in Australia. I'll be honest, I found it very slow. It's a thick book. Not a lot happens in it, but I'm sure, you know, if you're more familiar with Australia and its culture and its history, there's probably a little bit more there to, you know, dig your teeth into. I really wasn't that familiar with it, but you know, Pat, it has the scope of something like this particular book feels like almost like an Australian version of like The Grapes of Wrath or East of Eden. It feels like a little bit like Steinbeck or that type of a book, or at least it felt that way to me. And, but Patrick White, I think you're going to bring him up a little bit later. So we'll put a pause on that. Another really well-known and prominent writer from Australia is named David Malouf, Malouf. He's of Lebanese descent. He has at least one of his parents is from Lebanon. So that's why he has, you know, his last name may not necessarily sound like it's from Australia, but then what does that mean really? Australia. And we'll get into this as we go along. The history of Australia has some interesting parallels to the history of the United States. It's kind of a melting pot in some ways that mm-hmm. was established by, well, quote unquote, established by white Europeans, mostly Brits in this case, but all they were doing was supplanting a much older, you know, culture and indigenous people. So we'll get into that, I'm sure, a lot. But David Malouf, if I'm saying that right, is, I think, one of Australia's greatest writers. He has many novels. He has a few short story collections. He also has an extensive body of work of poetry. I don't know if you were familiar with that, Jude, but he's a highly regarded poet. I've read a couple of his novels. One was called Flyaway Peter, which is about an Australian young guy from Australia who goes to who serves in World War I and comes back to Australia and kind of deals with the aftermath of that. And then there's a book that we both read called An Imaginary Life, which isn't even set in Australia, but it's sort of it's imagining the life of the poet Ovid, Greek or Roman, I can't even remember, I should know that, but sort of living in exile on an island in the Mediterranean region. And I read that a long time ago and don't really remember it. But I did read a number of his short stories kind of leading up to this discussion, and they're very powerfully written, and they're very evocative of the Australian landscape and sort of the effect that Australians kind of physical beauty and the physical world of Australia and kind of how that impacts the people there. I think that's something that you see come up again and again with Australian writers. There's something about, you know, the physical nature of the place and its vast deserts and its red rocks and its, you know, not indigenous, but I'm trying to think of the word, you know, the wildlife that only exists there and nowhere else in the entire rest of the world. You know, there just seems to be kind of an air of mystery around Australia, which I think Malouf, you know, it sort of permeates all of his stories in a really interesting way. So
not to mention, John, sorry to interrupt you, but not to mention the extensive coasts of Australia, like the coastal regions all around, you know?
Yeah, because it's like a large island, so there's coasts everywhere, and we're going to touch on it later, I know, with at least one of our writers. But one of the many fascinating aspects of Australia is that, you know, most of the population is on those coasts, and the interior, also known as the outback, is this kind of vast, dry, arid place. You know, Australia is roughly the same size as the United States in terms of area. It might be a little bit bigger, but that's kind of the size that we're looking at. But a whole lot of the middle part of it is, if not uninhabitable, is really rugged and hard to survive. And I think that inevitably has an impact on the culture there, and certainly on the, you know, the Aboriginal people there, which we'll get into later. But, you know, those are... And then the third prominent writer that I think comes up a lot from Australia is a guy named Peter Carey. And he's written a ton of novels. And I know he's an author that we've talked about before. You may have read one of his books. I'm not sure. You're actually telling me that you met the guy, which you can tell that story if you want, during your time studying writing at the New School in New York City. But there's one novel in particular from him that I think is worth mentioning, although neither of us have read it, unfortunately. But it's called The True History of the Kelly Gang. And I bring it up because here you have a very prominent writer from Australia, and this story of kind of a famous outlaw, basically, from Australia named Ned Kelly, who I don't know his history that well, but I know he was involved. It's kind of like a Western myth that we have here. It's kind of like Billy the Kid or Wyatt Earp.
Jesse James,
he's that type of a figure, and he was involved in a gunfight towards the end of his life, and I think he was killed in the gunfight. But again, there are very interesting parallels between Australian history and ours. But that has become sort of like almost canonical or mythic text for the country of Australia. And if there's any book that I would like to read a little more of Peter Carey, I've read one of his books, which is called Oscar and Lucinda, which is also set in Australia. But that would be the one that I would really be interested in reading from Peter Carey. So he's another novelist that a lot of people have heard of. He's written many books. So I thought we should at least mention some of these well-known writers from Australia that unfortunately we're not going to cover in depth. But anyone who would be interested in reading writers from this region, I'm sure could do a lot worse by picking up one of their books. Do you have any, I know most of your books, I think, are ones that you want to discuss in a little more detail, but are there any other writers that you wanted to bring up that, that you thought you just mentioned in passing?
Yeah, I'll just mention a couple things really quick. First of all, I'd say, at least in my case, before, in general, I was surprised going through all my lists of books that I've read through the years. I kind of had like a paucity. I thought I had more books that I had read either set in or about Australia, particularly on the nonfiction side. But my list was actually pretty slim, even though I love a lot of the books I'm going to mention tonight. And then one of the consequences of that is that I have very little experience with women from Australia who are writers. So I just don't know a lot of books, Australian books written by women. In fact, I would encourage the audience, if anybody who listens and wanted to send us a message and had Australian female writers that they wanted to recommend, I'd be very happy to hear that if you feel so inclined. So I don't have a lot. There's one particular novel I'm going to speak, I think we're both going to talk about, that's by a woman, but I just don't know a lot of female Australian writers' work. And then, John, I didn't even mention this in any of our conversations leading up to this, but there is one writer I want to mention really briefly that I forgot. I can't believe I did. There's a very prominent writer that I haven't read yet from Australia, but I invested in a volume of his collected fiction this year. His name is Gerald Murnane, and he's a very highly reputed writer from Australia of both novels and short stories. There's this big, thick volume of his collected fictions. It's supposed to be very challenging. I bought it. It's called Stream System, and it's jammed with, it's got tons of stories in it. Some of them are short, but some of them are quite long, and I've heard has a great deal to do, again, because this is going to come up a lot with the environment and the natural landscapes in Australia. his fiction, I guess, is greatly informed by that. But I got to tell you, I have yet to read an Australian writer that doesn't have kind of a close affinity with the landscape. So that's pretty interesting by itself. So I do want to mention Gerald Murnane. And then, John, I just wanted to, we talked about this, but I'll just do it very briefly. You know, we had a whole episode once about an American writer by the name of Jim Shepard, who's a very adventurous short fiction writer in particular. He's also an accomplished novelist, but he writes a lot of short stories, and people can check out our Dealer's Choice episode on Jim Shepard early in the history of our show. But he writes short stories that take place throughout history and also in very many varied and sundry parts of the world. And he has two very excellent short stories that he specifically set in the wild outback of Australia. One is a story called Intimacy, which is, and they're kind of similar, at least in a broad way. They're both about parties kind of trekking through the Australian outback, but an Intimacy has to do with a historically gigantic storm that that a group of explorers or people who are, can't remember really well, making their way through the outback encounter in the middle of the Australian outback, this historically large storm, and how they try to survive that. And then there's another one kind of similar called the First South Central Australian Expedition. And it's about these people, I think they're, it's the 19th century, and they're also kind of traveling through a vagabond group of people traveling through the Australian outback. But the difference in that story is they're dragging a huge boat, a little bit like that Werner Herzog movie, John, Fitzcarraldo, where the guy drags a boat over a mountain.
Yes.
They're dragging this huge whale boat through the Australian outback in search of a mythic, might be there, might be not, lake that's reputed to be in the middle of the outback. So those are two. Jim Shepard is such an incredible short fiction writer that I just wanted to bring those two stories up. If anybody, you know, wanted to take on one of those, I guarantee you the whole book would be worth reading. But you would talk about reading around the world. You would end up going to many places in the world if you read one of those volumes of short stories by Jim Shepard. But anyway, that's, I'm going to put a lid on it there, and then we can get into the books that we want to discuss at greater length.
Well, a few other things I want to say before we get there in response to what you just said. Number one, there must be, I don't know, there's something, well, that might be two, just two examples might not be enough to call it a pattern. But I'm reminded, you talked about the Shepherd story where they're dragging a whale boat through the outback. And weirdly enough, the book that I mentioned by Peter Carey, which is called Oscar and Lucinda, is a love story between these two titular characters. But one of them is the son of a very strict preacher somewhere in the Australian hinterland. And he has, I don't remember a ton of the book, but much of the book involves, he has a glass church built, like all glass. And then he drags the church across part of the Australian outback to another, as part of like a pilgrimage or something. And that's why, I'm sure that's why I read the book, because I thought that sounded like a wild concept. And unfortunately now I don't remember a ton of it. But a lot of that book is him like sort of on this weird pilgrimage where he's literally dragging a glass church to a new location across the wilds of Australia, which is insane. You know, so yeah. pretty interesting.
Yeah, and just real quick, that's wild. I didn't know that about Oscar and Lucinda. But I know that's one of his famous books, but just for the record, I've been to Mystic, Connecticut and visited the last extant whaling ship from the height of the whaling era in the 19th century. And I just want, we're talking about a huge hunk of wood. We're talking about a gigantic boat. We're not talking about a little rowboat. We're talking about a gigantic, you know, handcrafted boat made out of big, heavy wood. It's just insane to think of people dragging across the outback. But anyway.
It's crazy. The other thing before we get into kind of our main selections that we wanted to talk about is you mentioned that you just weren't that familiar with many female writers from Australia. I have a couple that I want to mention that either I've read or are well known. The first one I only is a contemporary writer who I think is pretty well known. I did not realize, well, I did when I read one of her books, but it's a name that you hear come up. It's kind of a generic sounding name called Jane Harper, and she writes like kind of mysteries, and I think they're pretty good sellers right now in this moment. And she wrote a book called The Dry, which is basically a murder mystery set in the very dry, you know, Australian outback. And I read that book. I don't remember a ton from it. It's kind of like, in my opinion, like there wasn't anything that really stood out about it. Sort of like an investigation into a murder, and the guy gets sort of personally involved with it. And I remember it involves like some kind of great conflagration or fire that takes place in a country house out in the very, you know, dry and arid Australian desert. But she's kind of a best-selling writer right now. If anybody's interested in, you know, crime or mystery stories, in her case, set in Australia, she would be one to check out. The Dry was made into a film. Do you remember that book at all? It's only a few years old.
I didn't realize Jane Harper was from Australia, but I don't know how I didn't know that. But yeah, I remember you reading it, and I think I've seen and heard of it before. Oh, it was a film.
Yeah, and speaking of films, there's another book that much older, but it was a very well-known book when we were young kids, called The Thornbirds. And it was made into a TV miniseries. Remember that? By someone named Colleen McCullough. That was like a huge seller, and she's from Australia as well. And it was, again, kind of a love story set in Australia. I believe it was the 19th century, involving, I think, a priest. Or there's some kind of a love triangle involving a priest, but it was kind of a romantic miniseries that was big when we were kids. Remember that?
Yeah, good one.
That was a really big seller. So that's another book that people may be familiar with. But Australia does have a few well-known, or not a few, there's probably more than a few, but one of their most prominent fiction writers is a woman named Kate Grenville. I don't know, have you heard that name before?
Yes, but I couldn't tell you anything about her work.
Well, we're gonna talk about a book later by somebody named Richard Flanagan. And Kate Grenville, a lot of comparisons are drawn between his work and her work. And one of her best-known books, and I bring this up, you know, because part of this show is kind of giving recommendations, not only to listeners, but each other. But one of her best-known novels is called The Secret River. And it's loosely based on her own family's history, but it has to do with interactions between Australian settlers and the native Aboriginal people who live in this certain region. And it has a lot to do with Aboriginal culture. And I think it's one of the prominent novels to come out of Australia that really, you know, kind of grapples with the legacy of Westerners, you know, who have stolen both literally and culturally a lot from the, you know, indigenous people there. And this is a novel that really gets into that. And the more I read about the, you know, Aboriginal people of Australia and New Zealand and Tasmania, the more fascinated I get. And so that's a book that's really on my radar. I would love to read that sometime. And I read somewhere that, you know, somebody drew a parallel between that book and Flanagan's first novel, which is called Death of a River Guide. And I think the two novels are similar in that they really have to do with the interaction, you know, the sort of non-Western history of these regions, and what has been happening there for millennia before Western man even got there. So to me, that sounds like sort of like catnip. I would really love to read that book. So I thought it'd be worth giving, you know, bringing up. So that's one you could maybe keep an eye open for too, by Kate Grenville.
Oh yeah.
And then I'll mention one more, and you know, I read this, but there's a, you know, a book from New Zealand, a well-known novel that was called The Bone People, that was written by a woman named Carrie Holme. I think I'm saying that right, Hulme. And she is either part or all, she's of indigenous descent, and writing specifically about the Maori people, who were the indigenous people on the island of New Zealand. And that's kind of like sort of a separate branch of, you know, from the Aboriginal people from Australia. And we may be misspeaking some of this stuff. We're not experts in this stuff, but the Bone People is a big thick novel about a Maori woman who is kind of a hermit, lives on her own. She's an artist. She lives in a very unique kind of tower that she built for herself on a beach. And she basically is sort of a recluse, and she sort of slowly begins to fall in love with another Maori man who has sort of this adopted son that he has sort of taken on. And so by falling in love with this man, she sort of takes on the son as well. And he's like a young kid. And it's a book that's very, very much, you know, immersed in and concerned with Maori culture. And I did not find the main character, who's this sort of like reclusive woman, I didn't find her the most likable character, but I really admired the way the book was. It's a long kind of almost like an epic book about her life, and she has a terminal illness that she hasn't told anybody about, but she's sort of grappling with basically the big questions of life. But it's very much, the book is very much doing so in a way that also presents and engages with the Maori way of seeing the world. So it's mysterious. It's interesting. It's hard to get your head around, but it's a really an ambitious book called The Bone People that I think is really worth acknowledging. And I think it was, you know, it's probably the most well-known book written by a Maori woman, certainly, that still has a readership today. And that, you know, I couldn't get through this episode without mentioning it. Even though I kind of wrestled with the book, it wasn't necessarily my favorite book, I thought it was really ambitious and unique, and I thought it was worth bringing up. So that's The Bone People. I think, did you give me a copy of that book, or did I give one to you? Because I think you might have a copy on your shelf.
No, I don't.
Okay.
As far as I know, you didn't give it to me, and I don't know if I gave it to you, but I do. It's possible. But I do know it's a well-known book. I think it was published in the 80s. Isn't that right, John?
Yeah. Yeah, it was published in the 80s. And she doesn't have many novels. She might have one or two more, but this is really kind of the magnum opus from her. Really, yeah, interesting.
I remember you reading it and sort of grappling with it, but sort of admiring it at the same time. It wasn't too long ago, like within the last year, right?
Yeah, I think it was maybe a year ago or so. Yeah, you're right. But it's one of the more unique books I've ever read, that's for sure. And one of the reasons why it's not easy to contend with is because, you know, the worldview, and we'll get into this probably more later, but the worldview of the Aboriginal people from Australia and the Maori people is just so vastly different from the Western way of seeing the world, that it's really hard to grasp. So for people like us who are, you know, raised by Western values, whatever those are.
Yeah, like that is an aspect of at least the Native people and literature that deals with the Native people. There's like kind of a veil of like a bit of a language barrier, you know, not literally, but like, you know, some of these concepts, and we'll get into it with some of the books that we're going to talk about, are really, 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 again, self-evident, but foreign to us. And it makes some of these books really difficult to penetrate for a Western reader, definitely an American reader, you know? And that's going to come up again, too.
I have to mention this, Jude, even though this is off script, and you know, we're not a movie podcast, but one of the things, I didn't even tell you this, but one of the things I've been doing kind of get myself in the mindset for this episode, which is really nerdy, but what the hell. You know, we're also big movie fans.
Right.
And I found, now, one of my...
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, one of our favorite filmmakers that we've talked about offline a lot of times is an Australian filmmaker named Peter Weir. And I love Peter Weir. He's made many movies which are among my favorites, like Master and Commander, like Dead Poets Society. But he started his career, of course, in Australia.
Wait! You gotta mention the one. You gotta mention my favorite.
Oh boy, you're testing it.
It's called Witness.
Oh, Oh, Witness. Oh, gosh, of course, because you wrote a brilliant story imagining a sequel to Witness. Yeah, Witness. And these are none of these movies that we've mentioned really, you know, harken back to his Australian roots. But when he started, he made a number of movies set in Australia. One of them is called The Last Wave. And I don't know. Have you ever seen The Last Wave?
Yeah, you saw it many years ago, told me about it. I did watch it, but it's been a long time. But go ahead.
Dude, it is free on YouTube. I've been watching it again. I was hoping I could work this in somehow, but it fits here because I love The Last Wave. It's one of my, I love Peter Weir. The Last Wave is one of my favorite movies by him. That movie is bloody fascinating. And the whole thing is about, it's about a lawyer who lives in Sydney. He gets involved in a case that involves Aboriginal clients and he takes them on, even though he's not like a criminal lawyer. He gets involved, he takes the case, and he gets sucked into their whole way of looking at the world. He starts having these weird dreams, and these Aboriginal people who he barely knows start interpreting the dreams, saying, you know, there's, in our view, there's a lot more going on here with your dreams, and they're trying to tell you certain things. And it's one of the best, it might be the best movie I've ever seen that portrays, I'm not sure I'm going to say this right, but the interaction between like modern culture, you know, Western culture that is literally laid over a culture that's much, much older, and you could argue wiser, but certainly looks at the world in a totally different way. And you have, you know, most of it takes place in Sydney, but there's this whole other dimension to reality that's going on amongst the Aboriginal people. And as this guy gets drawn into it, it just gets weirder and weirder and more mysterious. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's one of the best things I've ever seen that looks at, you know, the clash and kind of interaction between Western culture and an indigenous one. And it has a really slam bang ending. That's such a good movie. But if anybody has any interest at all, you know, in Aboriginal culture and, you know, how different it is from Western culture, I would like immediately point them. I'd say go on YouTube, find The Last Wave. It's a great movie. It was made in 1977. It's still really powerful and mysterious, and it's beautiful. I love it. So I've been watching it again, and I'm just totally immersed in it. So that's just a random movie recommendation, but I have to say, sometime you got to go back and watch that. Such a good movie.
Yeah, good tip. Yeah, I'd be happy to. I love Peter Weir.
Oh boy, if anybody, even if you have never been interested in that before, but you happen to read one of the books we mentioned here and you sort of have any interest in all in Aboriginal culture, you need to find that movie and watch it because it's just fascinating. But anyway, so those are some of the writers that we wanted to mention before. I think we have some books. I know we have a few books that we've both read and wanted to discuss. I'm going to pass it to you. What is the first book or writer that you would like to recommend to our listeners and, you know, kind of dig into here as part of this episode on Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania?
Okay, yeah. Does it have to be one that we're both going to discuss, or can it be my own choice?
Whatever you want, whatever choice you have.
So we always say this. I think I can cover, I have five books I was going to bring up. I think I can cover them, at least the ones that we're not both going to be discussing, because we have a few titles that are kind of overlapping between the two of us. But there's one book I wanted to bring up first, and it's by a writer that I've mentioned many times in this podcast, you know, but I haven't talked about this particular book a lot, I don't think. The writer's name is Tim Winton, and he's a contemporary Australian novelist, short story writer. He also writes young adult novels. The book by him, I'm a huge fan of Tim Winton, and I'm going to try to say in a pithy way why I'm really arrested by his work. But the book I want to talk about, and I can describe just briefly, I think, is an earlier book of his. It's called Cloud Street, one word. And it came out in 1991. He's written a lot of books since then. I think this is like maybe, wasn't his first book, but kind of early in his catalog. And you mentioned,
it's funny, you mentioned books like East of Eden, Steinbeck, and like sort of epic kind of novels like that. This book by Tim Winton is kind of an epic type of book. It has that feel of kind of a big epic, like a big family novel like East of Eden or, I don't know, I'm trying to think of other ones, but just sort of like, you know, novels that have like a big, maybe like Lonesome Dove or something, or like, you know, big
like involving families.
Like, yeah, Faulkner for sure. Yeah. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, because you faded a little on me, but we'll keep going. Cloud Street is set in a suburb of the city of Perth, which John mentioned that most of the population, at least the white population or the population that emigrated to Australia, is on like kind of the coastal regions. Perth is a city on the western coast of Australia, southwest. It's the region that Tim Winton is from. Cloud Street is set in a suburb of that city. It's like basically a story about these two very different, large, kind of eclectic families that occupy one big sort of old house with a lot of character. And they live together in this house, kind of commingling and just living these weird and bizarre lives because they're so different from each other. In a kind of semi-impoverished situation across a period of about 30 years. And that's like the novel. It's this epic about two families living together in a big house and what those families go through. They go through, you know, their own tragedies, and they get into a lot of conflict. And some of them work in like the coastal region. It has a lot to do with the coasts of Australia. And it's this big sprawling book with a lot of humor. It has some, like, I wouldn't say like Garcia Marquez, but it has sort of brushes against like magical realist elements, John. Like, mm-hmm. There's this one of the families has a pig, and the pig sort of speaks in tongues in the little pen behind the house every once in a while. Like the and one of the, kind of like Faulkner, one of the families has a prominent son who has like mental disabilities. And he has the ability to kind of converse with this pig. but I thought it was just, I read it and it was the first book I read by Tim Winton. I just heard of him by reputation. I was utterly kind of enamored with it. It really drew me in and immersed me into the story. It might be too strange and exotic for certain American Western readers. I'm not sure. But I want to just springboard off that really quick and just say that led me to read other books by Tim Winton, and I really admire him as a writer. There's something about his work that's very powerful to me. I think I am safe to say that he's kind of more of a masculine writer. He has male characters that go through a great deal of struggle and don't know how to deal with their emotions. And that's often reflected in either like really hard work or like sort of a lonesome or solitary existences in some coastal region where they're kind of distant from other people. And last thing I would say is I think two elements of his books really stand out to me. One is sort of his inherent, you can tell there's a deep and almost awestruck love for the land itself. You know, we were talking about it earlier. There's a great love that comes out of his beautiful prose writing about Australia, particularly the coasts, the land, etc. And that really comes out strongly in his work, his love for the land and for the country itself. And the other thing is I think he has this very compassionate heart about him, and there's a real love you can feel. I know it's kind of a weird thing to say, but between the writer, the creator, and the characters, I think he has a real heart for the people he writes about, both men and women. At least one of his novels is like a really kind of striking romance called Dirt Music between these two people that have been like affected by terrible tragedies, just like trying to find each other. I think in his books, there's an amazing compassion for the people that he's writing about, and really makes them
come alive. So I'm going to leave it there. Cloud Street was a book I read in the last 4 or 5 years, and it has stayed very deep within me. So I'll leave it at that, Cloud Street.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. You can hear me okay, right?
Yes.
Okay. I was getting a little bit of an echo there, but, you know, we're still trying to figure out the audio here, folks. So hopefully this comes out okay in the wash. But that's a great recommendation. You turned me on. I really didn't know anything about Tim Winton at all until you kind of, you know, I think basically read Cloud Street and were telling me how much you liked it. And, of course, with this book exchange, you know, when that happens, you know, your ears perk up for sure.
Yeah.
And then you gave me a short book. I'm trying. What was the title of the book you gave me? Blue something?
Yeah, I can't even remember that.
Anyway, I read it, and I read the book, and it was a kind of a. It was about him, sort of, about the west coast of Australia, which is very different part of Australia than a lot of the books we're going to be talking about. Many of the books we'll be talking about are set on the eastern part of Australia, where the British had, you know, most of their settlements early on. You know, Sydney's on the east coast. Brisbane is on the east coast. Adelaide is way down south, but towards the east, whereas Perth is all the way to the west. The only reason I know this is because I've been looking at Australian maps, you know, in preparation for this episode. It's not like I've been there. But Western Australia is kind of like Western Ireland. It's more rugged. It's more remote. And Tim Winton wrote this beautiful book. I can't believe I don't remember the title of it, but it had a lot to do with, you know, the coast and living along the coast and surfing. He's a big surfer. He talks a lot about.
It's called Land's End Edge, John. Land's Edge.
Oh, okay. Lance is so much for blue. I think maybe he's got another book that has the blue in the title. But anyway.
Does, yeah, but go on.
But one thing I noticed when I read that book is he is a beautiful prose writer. So that I could see right away what appealed to you there, just because you're a writer yourself, and incredible prose is something that you're always drawn to. But you could really feel, as you said, his love for the land and the landscape that he grew up on and spends a lot of time on still. And then there's another book you've talked about before on this show called The Shepherd's Hut, which I read on your recommendation. And here's where we might get a little controversial, because I really admired and liked the book. I liked the book. I didn't love the book the way that you did. Uh-huh. It didn't have the impact on that you described it had on you. And I remember I got to the end of the book. I said, we're pretty closely aligned with our tastes, but just did not hit me the same way it did you. I think it's about this kid who goes out into the outback, and he sort of meets this sort of defrocked or disgraced priest who's living as a hermit kind of out in the wilderness, and they spend time together, and really, like, nothing really happens, you know, between they just kind of hang out. And I kept waiting for like something to happen, I think, and it never really did. I don't know, there's something about that book that kind of brought me right up to the edge of some kind of great mystery, but didn't let me get behind the curtain. But Winton is a beautiful writer, and certainly for someone who's alive and writing and well in Australia, you know, he would be a high recommendation from both of us, because he's just he's so tied to the land there. And I think you're right. You know, you mentioned that he writes with a lot of compassion about his characters, and that really comes through. But I've never read Cloud Street, and it sounds like one, if you've enjoyed anything by Tim Winton, you got to get to that one at some point. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting.
Excuse me.
I can see it, you know, like, I could, you know, mount my own case for The Shepherd's Hut, but I won't do that. But like, you know, he may not hit everybody the same way. The only other thing I would say about him is, I know it's kind of weird if you haven't read his work, but he's a really amazing interview, and there's lots of podcasts and YouTube videos with him discussing his work, and I watched a lot of those, and that may have had some effect about how I feel about his work. But anyway.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because one thing I did, you told me that, you know, kind of personally, and I listened to a long talk that he gave. And this is interesting because you mentioned that about how these books tend to be kind of more about masculine characters who don't really know how to handle their own emotions or just can't really express or relate to others the way that they know that they should. And somewhere, I guess I was looking for podcasts because I take these walks, these long walks in the morning, and I was looking for a podcast, and I listened to a long talk he gave in which he basically, it was like a 45-minute apology to women about the way men can be. And it was really, it was all about men and women and the way how men struggle to express themselves. And sometimes that leads to violence. And it felt like a 45-minute apology, you know, and I don't say that in a negative way. It was very interesting. It was a little bit like, okay, I felt like, okay, we get the point, you know, but at the same time, with you making the comment you just made, I see why, you know, that person who made that talk, you know, I could see how that's a major preoccupation of his fiction, because he clearly has thought a lot about the way men and women relate, and this might have to do with his own personal experience. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, in a weird way, he's sort of saying, you know, how important it is to sort of get in touch with your own emotions and be vulnerable. And, you know, that's something that's important for everybody to work on. So, you know, I kind of have mixed feelings about it, but I respect where he's coming from. And there's no question when you read Tim Winton, there's, you know, you immediately like, okay, I'm in the hands of a very talented writer, you know?
Yeah, and maybe because of his... He may indeed have kind of a hang up with some of that type of subject, maybe related to his own experience or his own struggles. But one thing that does achieve is that it makes his work more of a universally palatable type of fiction writing. You know, like it crosses borders just because he focuses on some of that stuff.
Definitely. And there's no question that, you know, for a lot of men, it's hard to kind of like express what you might be feeling emotionally. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So, but we'll move on. I know there's at least three books that we were going to sort of discuss in tandem. So I'm going to bring up one that I don't think you're going to talk about because you haven't read it. So I'm going to go to the movie world really briefly here. Jude, have you ever seen the Nick Rogue film Walkabout?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So that's a very, Nicholas Rogue is a famous English filmmaker. He made a lot of well-known movies and sort of in the 70s and 60s, 70s, early 80s. Don't Look Now is a famous horror kind of thriller that he made, which is outstanding.
Yeah.
He made a movie called Performance with Mick Jagger. He made a science, weird, dreamy kind of science fiction movie with David Bowie called The Man Who Fell to Earth. These are all pretty famous movies. But his other kind of very famous movie from the 70s is called Walkabout. And it was based on a novel, which I saw the movie because I saw Don't Look Now. I love Don't Look Now. Please don't tell me you've never seen Don't Look Now.
No, I've seen it.
Okay. It's just an incredible horror movie.
You can't
forget it. Absolutely. And so based on the strength of that, I was interested in his work. And so I know Walkabout is one of his most famous movies, and Walkabout is great. Someday you need to see that. And it's the story, and it's based on a novel, which I didn't know, but I came to the novel, you know, much later. In fact, I only read it this past week, but it's a short, slim novel. And the novel actually turns out to be quite a bit different than the film. But the gist of the story in both is that you have a young, kind of young teenage girl who's about 13 or 14, and her younger brother who's about 7 or 8. And I don't remember in the movie, I think the movie it might be a little bit different, but in the novel they're involved in a plane crash. They're traveling from the United States to Adelaide, but their plane crashes in Northern Australia, which if you look at a map of Australia, that's about the opposite side of the country from Adelaide, which is way down south. And they crash in the Northern Territory, and they're literally in the middle of the Outback. And I think they're with their father. It's not really clear, but anyway, they're on their own. You know, everybody dies in the plane crash except for them. And so they're kind of like the Australian Outback is, it's incredibly dry. It's incredibly wild. It's incredibly vast. And it has all kinds of weird flora and fauna in it. It's a dangerous place to be under any circumstances. But you have these young kids. You have this teenage girl who's like not much younger than my daughter now, trying to lead her little brother. And there's no way they're going to survive out in the middle of the wilderness. But they come upon a young Aboriginal boy who is on what the Aboriginals call a walkabout, which is similar to other traditions with other Indigenous people around the world, where a young man, in order to prove his manhood, goes out into the wilderness and basically has to survive on his own and go a long distance. Although, that's how we see the walkabout. You come to find out that the Aboriginals see it in a very different way. But, you know, there's sort of this idea of the walkabout. But anyway, they encounter, in the middle of the Outback, they encounter an Aboriginal boy who they can't communicate with because obviously he speaks a different language. And the novel takes pains to say he'd never seen a white person in his entire life. And this book came out in the 1950s, by the way. So he's so remote. He's never even seen white people. He can't understand why their skin is so white. He thinks they have, you know, the Aboriginal people a lot of times will cover themselves in different colored kind of minerals and dust and stuff. So he thinks they have white dust on them, and he can't understand why it doesn't come off. But essentially the story is about how this young Aboriginal boy, even though they can't communicate, not only leads them to food and drink, but essentially helps them survive in the Outback until they can get to safety, and travels a very long distance with them. So that's the gist of the story. In the movie, it's a lot darker, and it ends a different way than the novel does. But in both cases, it's really interesting because you can still hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay. It's really interesting because the Aboriginal boy essentially ends up sacrificing his own life to help save this young boy and girl from a totally different race. He has no idea who they are or why they're there, but he helps them survive. He ends up giving his own life for them, essentially, almost like a Christ figure. And eventually they do make it to safety. And that's sort of the essence of the story. But the movie is a lot darker and more cynical. But I just read the novel, which is only about 140 pages or something. You can read it in like 24 hours. But the novel's fascinating because it presents the point of view of the young boy and girl kind of like looking at this Aboriginal boy and just not understanding at all what he's doing. But they become fast friends with him. And it also kind of pivots because I read that the author had, you know, befriended somebody who was an expert on Aboriginal culture. He steeped himself in Aboriginal culture. And so he'll turn the camera and he'll give you the Aboriginal's point of view on the kids. And he'll sort of explain what the Aboriginal person is doing and what his point of view is and why he's doing what he's doing. So you get this back and forth between not only these different characters, but these totally different ways of seeing the world. And it's fascinating. It's a great book. It's very short. But it really kind of, again, it's sort of like, is a great example of these two cultures sort of meeting. And the book, anyway, the movie's a lot darker than the book, but the book really shows how kind of like the core of humanity that they both share, even though their cultures are so vastly different, they find a way to communicate by expression and by sign language. And, the young girl is really put off because the boy's not wearing any clothes. He's, you know, he's totally naked. He doesn't think anything of it, but she's just mortified that he's standing there naked in front of them. But by the end of their arduous journey, she's lost all of her clothes because, you know, she only has one dress, and they're just totally comfortable with each other. And it's really kind of a fascinating look at two totally different cultures, kind of like coming to a sort of understanding, even though their way of viewing the world is so different. It's just a fascinating encounter. and it's a really short book. And I think, you know, it feels like, I hate to keep bringing up Steinbeck, but it feels like something like, and you'll know what I mean by this too, but like something like The Red Pony or Of Mice and Men. It's like this very slim novella that feels almost perfect, and you get to the end of it and you're like, that's like a, feels like a myth or something, you know? Like, it's just a perfect universal story about this encounter between two totally different cultures and how their, you know, common humanity helps them to overcome these kind of, you know, barriers between them. And I thought it was totally fascinating. And I really love the movie too, but it's a lot darker. So I would recommend both. But the book Walkabout, it's got to be one of the great books about that has to do with, you know, encounter between Western civilization and Aboriginal culture. So I really want to recommend, I mean, you can read it in a day. I would highly recommend that one.
Yeah. I remember you said you were going to read it. I'm not sure. I might be wrong. I'm not sure that you have said to this point who wrote the book. Did you? You brought up Nicholas Rogue.
I didn't. And he's one. The book is published under the name James Vance Marshall.
Okay. But
that's a pseudonym. This is a weird thing. For a guy, I think his name is Donald Payne or something like that. He's a British writer. But I mentioned that he got to know and sort of like consulted with an expert on Aboriginal culture. And the name of the expert was James Vance Marshall. So as a tribute to this man, he kind of took his name as his pen name, which is sort of weird. Wow. So like, and he published at least one other book called Songs from the Billabong, I think, which is an indigenous Australian term for some kind of geographical formation. I can't remember exactly what it means, but Billabong. It later became sort of a clothing brand, but that's where the word comes from. It comes from Aboriginal culture, which is interesting. But so, yeah.
Sounds like that.
Yeah, it's like didgeridoo or whatever, native instrument. Boomerang, or yeah. Kookaburra, or like. Fascinating. But anyway, so it's published under the name James Vance Marshall, but that's not the real name of the writer, and I can't quite remember what his name is, but that's probably why I didn't mention it. But it's a really good book. Oh, yeah. Like, I know you loved like Red Pony and Of Mice and Men. You would love this book. There's no doubt about it.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. And I didn't expect John Steinbeck to come up as many times as he has at all. I'm not even sure that I would put him in the same class as some of these books. Maybe. But if you remember, like, in particular, early Steinbeck works like The Red Pony, which is a short novella, or I'm thinking of things like maybe a little bit of Mice and Men, a little bit of an early novel called In Dubious Battle, and definitely an earlier novel called To a God Unknown. Some of John Steinbeck's earlier works had this, like, I don't know how to describe it, like a kind of almost a difficult to penetrate aura of mystery, myth in them that kind of disappears in his later work. And anyway, you kind of, and this book sounds like the type of book that has that element to it. Like just kind of a, you said it was almost like a myth and kind of a mythic quality. And there's definitely that in early works of John Steinbeck, you know, that have this like, almost like quasi mystical, magical, pagan buzzing underneath them. That I remember recognizing in many of Steinbeck's early works. This sounds like that kind of book almost, you know?
Well, that's an interesting parallel as well.
Yeah. So anyway.
Hey, I'm starting to get a bit of an echo here, which I'm afraid is going to come through on the recording. So why don't we take a quick pause and then start again?
Okay.
Yeah, let's start it up again in a second here. Hopefully it'll just be a second pause for the listeners. Okay, so Jude, we're back. That brings us back to you. Do you have another book you'd like to bring up as a recommendation for our listeners?
I do, yeah. Strong recommendation. This is going to be one that both you and I think, can discuss. So I'll sort of intro it, John, and then we'll do a little back and forth on it.
Nice.
If it works for you. This is the one that was written by a woman. So, and I recommend all the books I'm going to talk about, but this is one that has the pace and the structure of like a tightly wound thriller. The book is called The Hunter, and it's written by somebody named Julia Lee. I don't know much about her. It was published in 1999. I believe she only has like one or two other books that have come out since then. Not really all that familiar with them. The Hunter was also made into a film that stars, it's a small film, but it stars one of the great actors of both small and large movies, Willem Dafoe. And I have not seen the film. It's on Amazon Prime. But John, you have seen it, right?
I have. It was on YouTube for free, but I don't think it is anymore. But it's a really good movie worth seeking out. But did you know Julia Lee, by the way, is a filmmaker herself? She's made at least one movie, which is interesting.
Oh yeah, I think I knew that, but I forgot it. But anyway, real quick, the Hunter is a slim, fast paced novel, kind of enigmatic, kind of thrillerish. And what it's about, it's, I think it's set, is it set in Tasmania, John?
It is.
Okay, I couldn't remember if it was set in Australia, having to do with a Tasmanian animal, or if it was set in Tasmania, but it's about, basically it's about this sort of enigmatic, kind of shadowy, I called him in something I was writing, kind of almost a zoological bounty hunter. A guy out, you know, a self-made individual whose particular type of bounty hunting is to go after like animals and to hunt, you know, it's called The Hunter. You know, he goes to hunt animals that need to be hunted for one reason or another. And he's kind of like a mercenary, like he's a hired gun. And, you know, you sort of meet this guy at the beginning of this book, and he's basically sent, the whole book is he's sent on this mission into Tasmania in order to try to track down what's sort of rumored, or maybe even a little stronger than rumored, it's known that there's one remaining individual creature of a species known as a Tasmanian tiger. And there's a term for it in the novel. I think it's thylacine, maybe, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a medicine, but it's like that's like the Latin name for this particular animal. But it's the last existing Tasmanian tiger. It's like a creature, you can Google the animal. It's like somewhere across between what you and I know of as a tiger, smaller, and like a dog. Looks kind of like a tigerish jackal kind of thing.
With like zebra-like stripes.
Yes. And he sent out into the Tasmanian wilderness to find this last remaining Tasmanian tiger, and that's the book. But what he... So the story revolves around him kind of taking on this mission, and he's sent to this kind of remote area in Tasmania, which is an island state off of the coast. I think it's off the eastern coast, if I'm not wrong, of Australia, that belongs to Australia. It's like an island off the island, you know, like a smaller island.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes out there, and he basically takes up lodging in the home of a single mother who has a couple of small children, young children, who puts him up just for when he's like back in civilization, he's sort of resupplying or whatever to go back out and hunt this animal. But most of the time during the book, he's a solitary figure. He's kind of shadowy, and he's hard to get to know. So he goes out and he hunts after this tiger. But it turns out that the woman is kind of you come to find out that she's the wife of the last guy that went hunting for this tiger, I guess. And I don't think it's clear in the book whether or not, I don't think it's crystal clear in the book whether or not he was killed by the tiger, but that's kind of the assumption. Isn't that right, John? Kind of the conclusion that they eventually reach?
It's really left open-ended. I mean, it's sort of only vaguely hinted, but okay. You really don't know what happened to him. He might have just starved.
Okay. Well, anyway, and that's the story. What happens is he sort of gradually... He's kind of running from some of his own demons, which you eventually find out.
you know, somebody that he was in love with that he sort of left behind, and other things he's dealing with from his past. And he has sort of purposely chosen a way of life to distance himself from others, but he gets slowly drawn into a relationship with this woman who has two young children, and he forms a relationship with the young children during those times that he's back sort of resupplying and whatnot. And so mm-hmm. the novel toggles back and forth between times when he's like living almost this like quasi domestic life with this family that's lost their kind of male figure, and then going out and hunting this animal. And so the tension in the book is around, not only is he going to find this tiger and what's going to happen when he does, but also there's something that happens, you know, three quarters of the way through the book, like a tragic event around the family and sort of the consequences of that tragic event. So that's the novel in a nutshell. Did I do a fairly decent job of explaining what it's about?
Absolutely. Yeah, you really nailed it. Yep.
Okay. Well, John, this book comes with a high recommendation from both of us. You're kind of immediately impressed with Julia Lee's like lean and kind of lovely in its own spare way prose with which she writes the book. She's in total command of this story from soup to nuts. Again, there is a mysterious veil around all of the events in the book, kind of a mystery in the outback and the wilderness that he's making his way through to find this tiger. There's a mystery around the tiger itself, what it's like, what its life is like. Is it alive? What's it doing? Then there's a great deal of mystery to the character of the hunter himself. What's he running from? What's going through his mind? And these things are all kind of like explored through kind of the minutiae of his hunt for this tiger as he works his way through this very harsh landscape. And then at the same time, there's this, what's the word I want? Like a convincing, slow building dynamic between him and this woman who's also suffered some losses. And what happens when something intervenes that, you know, prevents them from going further, you know, without giving too much away.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was kind of a magnificent short novel. I thought it was really powerful and kind of moving and had this kind of shadow of darkness around it. It's kind of exotic. I thought it was just kind of a rip-roaring performance. And, you know, I don't know how much more I could say, but let me toss it to you. Did you have a similar response to the book? And how you can talk a little bit more about, you know, whether the book and the novel are very similar? What would you say?
You mean the book and the novel and the film?
Sorry, the novel and the film, yeah.
Well, yeah, because you and I both read this, but we haven't talked about it. I think I actually gave it to you as a gift, and then I ended up getting a copy for myself because I had seen the movie.
You did, yeah.
I'd seen the film first, and I thought, man, this is such an interesting story. Oh, this is, you know, based on a novel written by a woman from Australia who, by the way, is born in the exact same year we are, so she's our age. And I thought, what's that book like? And, you know, I just kind of looked at it, and it sounded like it would be something you would enjoy, so I sent it off to you. And we've both read it now, haven't talked about it. I love this book, dude. Like everything you say, I want to see it and raise it, you know, by another 50. I thought this book was magnificent. It's slim. You said it very well. She's in total command of the story from the beginning. It's fascinating to me that this book about this, you know, middle-aged male hunter who is basically solitary through much of the book was written by this, you know, woman of our age. I mean, it's just an incredibly convincing portrait of this guy. And then you add on to that the fascination of being like he's hunting what is most likely the last known animal of its species and trying to find it. You know, its existence is rumored. And so it's like kind of like almost like a detective story. He's got to like look for signals in nature that this animal may exist. And of course, along the way, a lot of the book is him just on his own in the wilderness. And he sees all these other, you know, evidence of other animals, and he encounters these other animals. And, you know, of course, Tasmania, you know, I was like, you know, this is something we didn't mention before, but like the wildlife in Australia and down in this part of the world is like, is totally unique to this region, you know? Mm. So you have animals like kangaroos don't exist anywhere else. Wallabies don't exist anywhere else. Koala bears don't exist anywhere else. And, you know, in this book, you know, he encounters a wallaby, he encounters a wombat. I challenge you, what the hell is the difference between a wombat, a wallaby, and a Tasmanian devil? You know, and then there's a number there's a number of other creatures that she mentions that I didn't even know what the hell they were. So I'm like Googling while I'm reading this book. And then you, then the Tasmanian tiger, which is, you know, like a cross between three different animals, like you mentioned, has a 120 degree opening of the jaw. Like the jaw opens, extends more widely than almost any other animal. You know, it's like, what the hell is this thing? It's like, and, you know, I mean, I don't think it's a huge spoil. You know, the whole book is about him hunting this species, and there is an encounter. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler to say that.
No, I don't think so.
And when you get to that, it's fascinating, you know.
Very, yeah.
But on a human level, in terms of these characters that you described, on a biological, you know, zoological level, it's fascinating. And the writing, I'm going to read one little passage because I literally dog-eared this because I thought, I mean, the writing is like, the book garners comparisons to Hemingway. And it's kind of like Hemingway in like it has very economical prose, but it's also written by a woman. So you don't get that kind of masculine bravura that you get with Hemingway, you know, like, let's just fight it out with knives or, you know, a fist fight or something. You don't get any of that. But her writing is very spare, but it's beautiful. I mean, listen to this. This one line, I mean, I almost dropped the book when I read this line because I just thought it was so, it's just such an incredible line to come up with. So she's describing, he's out in the wilderness. This is no God's country. This is God forsaken. It is perfect and precise. Perfect thousand-year-old trees, their lowest feathered branches almost tip-tipping, an open, soft, and fragrant floor, the hard petals of each pine cone divisible by the golden mean. Like, when I read that last part, I was like, I don't even know what that means, but that's an unbelievable line to write. The hard petals of each pine cone divisible by the golden mean. It's like, you know, math, like it brings math in weirdly into the, I mean, it's just,
well, you get the feeling that this woman was really in the zone, you know, and it has this feeling like it could have been like a Tim Winton style book written by some guy about guys, you know, but it's not, you know.
It's
that's
not
the kind of amazing performance that Julia Lee gives in writing this book.
Right. It's a remarkable book because you mentioned it, but like, you know, it's a book about this solitary hunter that's on this mission. And it's treated in the beginning almost like he's like Jason Bourne almost. It's like, this is your, or Bond, like, here's your mission. No, not Bond, Ethan Hunt. This is your mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, go do it. And you know, like all these cliches, he gets all his equipment together. You know, there's probably a montage in the movie like, of his getting,
you know,
getting
striding his, like, off into the dark or whatever. You know, like just some guy, you know.
Right. This solitary lone hunter. Enigmatic. Oh, you can't get close to him. You know, don't mess with him. He's on a job. But yet, at the same time, he has this very tender relationship that he develops with this woman and her two kids. And I'm definitely not going to say what happens there. But that's another dimension of the book that really it sort of sneaks up on you. And it sort of punches you in the gut in a number of ways. I'll just say that, you know,
I was going to say, like, and I know we're stepping over each other, but that's what we wanted to do with these books, like the ones that we both read. But like, it's something that I would say, like, you know, you don't want to say what it is, but it's something that you know, he's not prepared for it all. Nobody would be prepared for it. It's something that sort of knocks you down, you know.
That's right. And then to top it all off, you know this sort of you assume this sort of encounter is coming, and when it does, it's like it almost turns it. It's almost like an alien story, you know. He encounters the alien, you know, and it's like you know, like it's just.
And then there's this incredible. I'm sorry. I'm not letting you continue.
No. I was just gonna say that final confrontation is just a fascinating one.
Not only that, but I don't know if you remember, like, what he, well, you don't want to give it away, but that there's an encounter, and then there's an aftermath to the encounter that's, like, very striking and extremely visceral, and it opens up this kind of, it opens up other possibilities that the novel sort of ends with you sort of, like, hinting at them, you know? And that's the best that I can say, you know.
Well, and it's interesting because we did not mention, and this is kind of a key piece that's sort of hovering in the background, is that the whole mission is being sponsored by a biotech company that is interested in the animal's DNA.
Right.
And so that's part of his mission, is to make sure he gets enough of the animal.
Iffy. And that too, like, this is 1999. That feels very way ahead of its time, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to put into words what an unusual sort of combination of elements this book is, and we should probably move on. But it's and as far as the film, like, the movie's really good. Willem Dafoe is the right kind of actor to sort of handle this kind of material.
Yeah,
I don't remember specifically how the movie ends, and I liked the movie a lot, but I think the book had a bigger impact on me than the movie did. You know, it's just a different experience.
Sounds like, yeah.
It's magnificent, you know, and I don't think she's written much else, but, you know, I would recommend this book to anybody.
So would I. Maybe she kind of left it all out on the field. I don't know. But yeah, I'd end on what you said. You know, if anything grabs you about this episode, you know, you ought to go find this book. It won't take you long to read, and it's really an amazing book.
That's right. So,
I think we can move on.
Let me see. There's one book I want to make sure I mention, but I think I brought it up before on another episode, so I'll try to be quick about it. But I can't do this episode without mentioning a book called The Whale Rider, which is by another indigenous Maori author by the name of Witi Imihira. I'm pretty sure I've talked about this on another episode, so I won't go on too long, but The Whale Rider was also made into a film. It has to be one of the most well-known books written by a Maori author in the world. It was obviously popularized by this movie that was made about it, which is a really good movie, too. I really enjoyed the movie. But the novel is noteworthy because of its deep immersion into Maori mythology. And there's a myth, I don't remember the name of the mythical character, but there's a myth that there's a certain character in Maori mythology who was carried on the back of a whale, basically, and carried to the island. Or the part of the island where this is takes place in the northern, New Zealand is sort of two big islands. There's a smaller one to the north, and this takes place there. And there's a myth that this certain god was brought to the island on the back of a whale, and sort of helped found certain tribes on the island, the northern island. So, and the movie, the book, you know, has these passages every once in a while. It just kind of like retells Maori myths. And so one of their traditions in this particular tribe in this part of New Zealand is that, you know, there's a, you know, they're kind of holy men in this tribe that, you know, pass their traditions down to a younger person who then becomes, you know, kind of takes on the mantle of being the leader of this tribe, and they become known, among other things, as the Whale Rider. They can communicate with whales. You know, they could literally ride on the back of a whale, but it's always a male, okay? It's always a young male that's chosen to be kind of carry this tradition on. And this movie is about a young girl whose grandfather is sort of the head of this tribe. And this young girl, you know, even though she's very, very young, she understands the songs of the whales. She is able to communicate with whales and other creatures. And she becomes clear to her and to some of the women in the tribe that she is the heir. She is the next, you know, whale rider in this community. But the grandfather is like, no, it can't be a girl. That's impossible. And basically rejects this young girl. And it's a story of her kind of being rejected by her grandfather, but her sort of communion with the environment around her, and specifically the whales. And eventually the grandfather is won over that, and there's something that happens with these whales, and they get beached, and this young girl is able to help save them. And he realizes that she is indeed, you know, for whatever reason, it's not always a boy, apparently, because this young girl becomes a whale rider in this community. And it's this sort of like mythic tale. It's almost like a fairy tale, but with a very deep immersion in Maori mythology. And it's just really simply written, very beautiful. You know, it could be read by young readers as well as old. And it's just kind of a moving story about this young girl sort of being, you know, recognized for who she is. And also, it's just a wonderful kind of like immersion into, you know, a totally different culture, in a totally different part of the world. But, it's a little bit like, I didn't plan this, but like Walkabout is a slim novel. The Hunter is a slim novel. The Whale Rider is a slim novel. You can read these books in 1 to 2 days. And all three of those books, I think, are wonderful reads that if you have any interest at all in this part of the world, you know, you got to read them. So The Whale Rider is a beautiful book. It's a beautiful movie. In the movie, they get this young girl. I don't know. She delivers this emotional powerhouse of a performance. I don't know how she does it. And like, it's really, it's worth seeing, but the book is certainly worth reading too. And, you just learn a lot about a totally different culture when you read it. So like, that's another recommendation I have to bring up, especially because there aren't that many books, period, that are well known by Maori writers. And, you know, if you're interested in this part of the world, this is one of the books you need to read.
Well, I'm not very familiar with The Whale Rider, really, although I've heard of it. You know, you do hear of it if you follow the world of books.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd certainly love to read it. You know, I've never read a book about the Maori people that I can remember.
Yeah, it's, you know, really interesting.
That region of this region, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something I would really love to read. It sounds like a wonderful story, and it's a very highly reputed book. You know, you know what? Like, when was the book published? Did you say?
I didn't, and I don't really remember, to be honest with you. You know,
okay.
It's a fairly contemporary book. I mean, I want to say like 80s or 90s, but
yeah, isn't the movie like kind of a 90s? Is it a 90s movie?
It might be 90s or like even early 2000s. It's a pretty,
okay.
Yeah, maybe 90s.
Okay.
But it's all filmed there. It's used a lot of indigenous actors. You know, it's really well done. You know, they do it. They really respect the material. And, you know, these tribes and these older traditions are just fascinating. So, you know, It's like being immersed in sort of an alien culture, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, couldn't do this episode without mentioning The Whale Rider. Really, I really appreciate that movie, but I know that there are other books that we both read we want to talk about.
Yeah, I think at this point, there were three more books I was going to talk about. I think I might lop one off because I just didn't know it less anyway. Maybe I'll mention it at the end, just so we can keep going. you know, and kind of fit it all in, if that's mm-hmm. all right with you. But there, but which means if I do that, the last two for me are books that we, again, we both read and would have like kind of a joint discussion of, and then there may be other books you want to bring up also. So I'll bring up one of those books now. I don't know, John, I don't know how we do this in a small space, but there's no way. The only nonfiction book I have on my list, although it's kind of arguably fiction and nonfiction in a weird way, but we can't do this episode without mentioning this book. And we also, I don't know how we talk about it in briefly, because it's just almost, this book is very almost impenetrable in some ways. But the book I'm talking about is called The Song Lines. All one word, The Song Lines. And it's written by somebody named Bruce Chatwin.
Bruce
Chatwin is English, right? And he, or was English, because he's... Are you there?
I am, but I don't know if these audio problems
are you there?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what's I can't hear anything that's happened, so I don't know what happened there.
I was having all kinds of trouble hearing you. I don't know if that's going to come through on the recording or not, but let's just press forward. But you might want to repeat the last couple lines that you said.
Okay. Thrown off a little, but I was just saying that I don't know how we do this episode without bringing up this book, and I don't know how we talk about this book in like a short space, but the book is called The Song Lines, all yes. one word. It's by Bruce Chatwin.
Yep.
And I believe, and he's deceased, and I believe he was English. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And Bruce Chatwin was both a novelist and a nonfiction sort of travelogue writer. He was well known as a travel writer. He wrote kind of like a semi-classic travelogue called In Patagonia that he was well known for. Right. And he also wrote at least one novel that I read called On the Black Hill, which was about twin brothers, identical twin brothers, growing up in Wales. And then one of them ends up going to fight in, I believe it's World War I, if I'm not mistaken. I read that, kind of an enigmatic book. Bruce Chatwin is enigmatic, but he later in his life, before he died, I believe he died of AIDS or a condition similar to AIDS.
Yes.
He traveled to Australia, the Australian outback, in real life, in order to conduct a study of the Aboriginal music, specifically songs that the native Aborigines would sing and had been singing since time immemorial. And he goes out into the outback, and this is recounted in the book. It's kind of a mix between a travelogue, but I believe a lot of it was fictionalized also. He goes out into the outback with a guide, at least in the novel, his guide is like a European who has grown up or like spent a great deal of time with the Aborigines and knows their language and culture. And they go out trying to encounter the Aborigines and find out about their ancient craft of singing. And as they do so, they learn about the existence, at least in the Aboriginal tradition, you can help me out if I'm getting this wrong, of these kind of like mythic lines or kind of highways going across the Australian outback, connecting one place to another,
mm-hmm.
that were kind of put there by the act of singing these ancient songs, if I have this right. And one of the phrases that is used in the book is that the Aborigine people kind of sang the world into existence through this ancient art of singing and forming these lines of connectivity between different places in their land.
Mm-hmm.
And those lines are called song lines. And they learn about the creation of those lines, quote unquote, and the meaning of the songs that created them. And from there,
They encounter a wide range of different characters, both native and white from Europe and white from other places. And the book begins to sort of transition into this highly philosophical meditation on the discursive nature of man himself and his propensity to wander and become a nomad and move about across borders and across landscapes. Why is man a wanderer, and what's he doing by wandering around the world restlessly? And the book ends up as kind of like a meditation on that nature of mankind. Let me pause there. That's how I would describe the song lines. Have I left anything out, or do you want to help me out with the description?
It's a really tough book. Are you hearing an echo?
I am not hearing the echo, so I would just kind of forge on. Hopefully it'll be okay. But it's probably hard for you if you're hearing it.
I hope it doesn't come through on the recording. It's a very difficult book to describe.
Yes.
But you did a pretty good job. of doing it.
Oh, man, I really hope this echo doesn't come through.
Yeah, I can't hear it, so hopefully it'll be all right.
Okay. But yeah, you described it pretty accurately. One thing I learned recently about the book, when Bruce Chatwin was writing it, Bruce Chatwin has this other writing project. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. He had this other writing project that he worked on for most of his life that was about, basically about man as nomad. He was just obsessed with the idea of man as being a wanderer. So he was working on this project about the sort of nomadic nature of man, life sort of wandering and restlessness is essential to man. And he traveled literally all over the world, kind of investigating different traditions and cultures, you know, in pursuit of this idea. And okay. So that's sort of what brought him to the Aboriginal culture and kind of, and so in the book, the song lines, which is, you know, part just sort of travelogue about him traveling to Australia and learning more about, you know, the Aboriginal view of the world and these song lines, which are also called dreaming tracks. The book kind of abruptly stops in the middle of the book, and then he just shares from his notebooks, different passages that he's either written or quotes from other books that have to do with man as wanderer and being a nomad.
Right.
And so there's this whole huge section in the middle of the book, which is just a compendium of other, you know, selections from other books or, you know, notes from his travels. And he literally travels all over the world. He's in everywhere from South America to different countries in Africa to Afghanistan, to Australia, you know, to parts of Europe. I mean, he's everywhere. And some pretty obscure places. And he's with the Tuareg tribes in the Saharan desert, you know, and he's sort of an obsession of his. And actually, you mentioned him before, a guy who was a really good friend of Bruce Chatwin's was the filmmaker Werner Herzog, who you mentioned before.
Right.
And I don't know if you remember this, but I actually found this and was watching a little bit of it again. And I came across it because I was rereading parts of the song lines coming into this discussion. And did you know that Werner Herzog made a movie about Chatwin called Nomad?
Oh, gosh. I might have known that, but I'm not remembering it just now.
I mean, he makes like 3 movies a year, Werner Herzog, right. But he made a documentary about Bruce Chatwin, and I was watching part of it. And somehow, it doesn't matter what Werner Herzog does, it's interesting. And so there's a whole section in there about Bruce Chatwin and the song lines, the book, and his sort of investigation into it. But this book is sort of unclassifiable. I think it's one of the most interesting books I've ever read, period. And it's certainly, I can't emphasize enough how it's an absolutely fascinating book to read about Aboriginal culture. I mean, mm-hmm. He really digs deep into what these song lines might mean. And I mean, you basically said it right. It's like part of their belief is that their ancient ancestors literally sung the universe into existence,
which is so hard to get your head around. Just that
notion. It is, although, but that's an idea that has had resonances in other cultures. I know, like, for example, C.S. Lewis, you know, writing about creation in the first volume of the of his fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia. The first book is called, I think, The Magician's Nephew, and it, you know, involves basically the lion Aslan singing the universe into creation, you know. So, like, it, you know, it's not necessarily an original idea to them, but they, what the Aboriginal people in Australia do is, like, these songs become literally like tracks that end up sort of mapping their country.
Yes.
And so all throughout Australian history, you have these conflicts between not only, you know, British and other, you know, colonials who are trying to take their land, but they're like, well, we're going to build a mine here, and we're going to build a railroad station, or a railroad track is going to go through this part of the country. And they say, well, you can't do that because this is sacred territory. You know, they're dream tracks all over these lands.
Yeah.
The British are like, what do you mean? And, you know,
yeah.
So, you know, it's very mysterious because they see and know of these tracks. Like, literally every hollow, every canyon, every rock has its own, you know, kind of like dream track that they're very aware of that we know nothing about, you know. So
you can't just, like, throw up your villa here for, like, your mistress, you know, like, you know.
Right. Or you can't, no, you can't just, like, plow all this rock or blow up all this rock so that this train track can go through.
Right.
Because,
right.
Like, our ancestors literally, you know, sung this part of the world into existence. So this is a book that really immerses you in this way of seeing the world and how they think about things, which is so foreign to us. But it also digs deeply, as you said, into kind of like the restless heart of man and what that might mean. It's a fascinating combination of sort of philosophy and mythology and also, you know, travel literature. There's nothing like it. It's really unique. I guess it's probably not for everybody, you know, but,
yeah, I mean,
I find it fascinating.
I do too. And you got it. Like, I mean, I know how pretentious this sounds, but it's really a thinking person's type of book. And I just mean, you got to be willing to get, this book goes deep, you know, and like, things that separate us from this culture, but things that unite us with this culture as well, you know, mm-hmm. on some really basic, deep level. And it's just, it's like you said, it's very hard to classify, very hard to get your head around even after you've read it. I think I might've struggled with it more than you. I haven't reread pieces of it, but once you've read it, you kind of, you know, it really expands your understanding and view of things. I don't know how else to put that, you know?
Well, and I'm kind of rereading it now, and that whole center section where he just dives into his own notes and he just brings up passage after passage from, like, you know, it might be from Indian scriptures, it might be from Greek tragedies, it might be from, you know, the French poet Rimbaud or Baudelaire. It might be from, you know, Native American traditions. But this idea of it might be from the New Old Testament, but this idea of man kind of wandering the earth. When you read all these different passages, you're like, wow, there really is something here. This is really, and, you know, it's just fascinating, you know. It really is. You know, we probably just leave it there. I know that there's at least one other book, kind of a joint read, that we wanted to discuss together before we wrap things up. You mind if I just mention a couple quick nonfiction titles before we dive into that? Or did you have another
book? Yeah, also? I think we'll probably only have time for that last joint discussion, but you should mention the other books you wanted to bring up, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, there's just two, you know, on the nonfiction side, you know, I've read a few nonfiction books about Australia as well, and there's a couple that I would recommend. One is a history of Australia, but from a kind of a certain perspective, and it's a book by a famous art critic named Robert Hughes. He was a British art critic, and kind of made his name writing about art, but he wrote this long, it's a book called The Fatal Shore, and it's called The Epic of Australia's Founding. And it's kind of a history of the British basically going down and setting up a whole series of penal colonies, you know, down in Australia and in New Zealand and Tasmania, once it was discovered by British people, by Captain James Cook in the 18th century. And they kind of used it as a, like one big penal colony, which a lot of people know. And this is kind of a history of how it grew from being a series of penal institutions and colonies into like its own culture. And it's a really interesting look at that part of Australian history. I mean, I say
John,
that.
John, I'm sorry to interrupt you with that line from The Princess Bride, Wallace Shawn talking about, you know, it's from Australia, which as everybody knows is populated entirely by criminals. the account of that.
Which, of course, you know, as we've been saying, this whole episode is not true at all, because there is an ancient established, you know, population that was already there doing just fine.
Yep, but, it's like our country.
Yeah, the parallels are amazing, but... it says a lot about Australia. I mean, I've mentioned Australian film. If you watch, you know, Australian books, Australian movies for sure, they have this kind of rough and wild edge to them. And you can't help but speculate that part of that is because so much of the population began with, like, you know, the outcasts of other countries.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's sort of a point of pride with Australians, but it's also just a very strange way to establish kind of a new civilization in a way, even though, again, I emphasize that there was already a civilization there. But this is a really interesting history of kind of like the Western view of Australia and how basically a series of prisons eventually became, you know, one of the great countries on the world stage. It's really fascinating. So for any history buffs who are interested in that, in the history of Australia, that's a good one to check out. And then there's another one I'll just mention briefly, because this wasn't, I didn't love this book, but there's a woman named Christina Thompson who has written a couple books about this part of the world. I think it was her first book that's called, I'm gonna mess this up because I had it written down, but I moved my location. But it's called something like "We Will Come on Shore and Kill and Eat You All." It's like the name of the title. Or come on to our shores and we will kill and eat you all. Something like that. And it's in part, and it's because this woman is either British or American woman. Should have done more homework. It's been a while since I read this, but she married a Maori man of Maori descent. And so she's living in New Zealand. And so the book is part a memoir of her relationship with this Maori man and part kind of like a book about the encounter between Western people and Maori culture. So it's a sort of it's part personal memoir and part sort of history of New Zealand, which is really cool. You know, the personal stuff isn't quite as interesting because you don't really know her. But I do want to mention that she went on to write a second book, which I have and have not read, but it's called The Sea People. And it's about the indigenous peoples that ended up, I don't remember which direction they traveled in, but there's one people that ended up populating, you know, a lot of Indonesia, the Hawaiian Islands, New Zealand, Australia, and all these peoples were linked by this incredible, you know, sort of like original race of people who somehow knew how to navigate across thousands and thousands of miles without any modern technology. And they made their way from, you know, Indonesia and that region and Malaysia and New Zealand over to Hawaii, which is thousands and thousands of miles. And they knew how to get there and back. And it's kind of a great mystery. How did they travel so far so long ago? So this is a book about these peoples who eventually populated all of these different areas across what is literally like a, like a, just a, in it, you know, almost a third of the globe. And no one really knows how they did it. So it's sort of an exploration on how they did that. So that sounds like a really, really interesting book. So I wanted to bring that up too. So that's called, the woman's name is Christina Thompson. And that second book is called The Sea People. I'm really looking forward to reading that someday.
Oh, yeah, that's very John Lovell, but I would read that in a drop of a hat, yeah.
It just sounds really fascinating, cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, that brings us to the, I know there's one more book that we really need to discuss, although we're sort of running out of time, but let's try.
Yeah, we'll have to do it quickly, but it's definitely got to be brought up. It's a book that we both read. So, like, do you want me to launch into it?
Sure.
Okay. It's a novel. It's called Gould's Book of Fish. And it's written by somebody John brought up earlier named Richard Flanagan, who's a writer from Tasmania, whose first novel John mentioned was called The Death of a River Guide. And he has other, he more recently than Gould's Book of Fish, wrote a novel called The Narrow Road to the Deep North that won the Man Booker Prize in England. And kind of made a big splash about, I believe it had to do with this kind of death march in maybe Burma or something like that. I'm not sure. Maybe Australia. I haven't read the book, although as I understand it, you bought me a copy in New York City recently and sending it to me. So thank you.
I did. You're going to be reading it soon.
Yeah. Awesome. I've read one book by Richard Flanagan called The Unknown Terrorist, which was another totally different story. He has many novels, but they're all very wide-ranging in theme. That happens to be about a terrorist who commits a terrorist act in Australia in more modern times. But probably about 15 or 16 years ago, John found Richard Flanagan's book, Gould's Book of Fish. Gould, G-O-U-L-D. And I remember him reading it. He was, like, totally knocked over by it. He attempted to describe it to me, which we'll get into a second because it's really hard. Another very hard book to encompass. And basically has been talking about it on and off for the last 15, 16 years. I believe you found a copy. I might be wrong. I believe you found a copy and sent it to me, or I saw it somewhere used and bought it because you wouldn't shut up about it kind of over the years. Yeah. But I had already read Richard Flanagan, and I knew he was a really good writer, he's a great writer. I think he's still alive. He was born and raised in Tasmania.
Oh, yeah, he's
but
alive.
Then I had it on my shelf. John, you just from time to time, you continue to talk about it. Then we decided to do this episode, fast forward all the way to 2023, and that was the one book I knew that I had to read. I read it. I thought it was absolutely incredible. It's one of the more... It's one of the best books I've read this year, for sure. It's one of the more amazing feats of the novelistic imagination that I've read in many, many years. It's very hard to describe.
well, it's a book. For one thing, it's divided into 12 sections that are all named for fish.
Yes, its subtitle is A Novel in 12 Fish. And, man, I'll just try. It's about this guy who...
Good luck.
Is born in England in the early part of the 19th century. He lives this vagabond lifestyle. He's kind of orphaned, whatever, knocks around, just doing weird things, picks up some painting skills just to try to make some money. He gets imprisoned for a crime that wouldn't seem to be like the end of the world. And as a result of his imprisonment, he's shipped off to this island off the coast of Tasmania, I believe, called Sarah Island. Early 1800s. I think I have that right. Early 1800s.
Turns out it's one of the most fearsome penal colonies in the entire British Empire. He ends up in this hellish place. He knocks around in the prison system there and endures torture and impoverished conditions and all of just unimaginable suffering. And then he's commandeered by this bizarre doctor slash scientist who works in the prison compound, who finds out that he has painting skills, and he demands that he start producing paintings for him. And during this whole experience, he spends all this time imprisoned in a cell that's hewn into the side of a cliff that fills gradually during every day, day in and day out, with seawater as the day progresses, until he's hanging from iron bars at the top of the cell with his arms, you know, trying to breathe through whatever narrow zone of air is left in the cell until the next day. And somewhere along the way, he decides that he's going to capture some of the bizarre fish that end up in his cell and render them in paintings through whatever means he has around him, and record, in addition to the paintings, he's going to record his life and times on these pages, and he creates this book of fish that is the novel, Gold's Book of Fish, with 12 chapters named after one of these bizarre fishes. So each chapter has a depiction of a fish, and then a discursive and wandering tale that fills the pages in between them. That's my best attempt to try to explain what Gold's Fish of Book of Fish is about. But the reason why I'm so, and then I'll just say a few more things, I'll pass it over to you, because you could probably do a better job that fleshing this out than I am. But it's just one of these books. It's just written in this incredibly immersive sort of arcane style that seems fitting to the time, but like a beautiful style of prose that describes all these horrific adventures and arid and devastating landscapes, and has sort of philosophical discursions, you know, backstories with romances, encounters between strange characters. In this book, there happens to be another huge pig that has kind of a mythic quality. And it's just one of these novels, John, when I started reading it, I was just totally blown away by the artistic achievement of the book, the prose itself, the imaginative flourishes in all of the writing. And it's, by way of conclusion, I would say, like, almost every page of this book had, like, I said to you, like, savagery and great beauty on almost every page of this bizarre and, like, just colorful and just totally nuts novel. And I was just totally captivated by it. I mean, I just kind of blew through it, and it immersed me into this horrible other world that was just, like, somehow mythical and fantastical. I don't know if I've ever read a novel quite like this one. And I'll stop. Can you help me, like, flesh out, you know, like, what was this book like for you? Especially that you remember it so well after so many years. Because you didn't reread it, did you?
No, but I don't remember it as well as you would, as well as you're saying. I just remember its impact on me. Like, I really don't remember the details. Like, your summary is perfect. It's this like convict.
Insane.
What's that?
It's insane. You know, like,
it's insane.
It's a hard book to describe.
And, you know, this, the main character is based on a historical person, apparently, who was an inmate at one of these prisons, you know, and there, I think there was a real Gould's Book of Fish. He was like a painter of fish. I don't think the part with his, the way he existed in this prison cell is actually true, although I don't know for sure. But the thing I would thought, and I don't, you know, each chapter, you know, kind of has these, like you said, sort of discursive stories from his life. I don't remember a lot of the details of those. But I would say, like, you know, we've talked on this podcast before about this. This book is like one of these very rare books that actually could be put on the shelf next to something like Moby Dick or Blood Meridian.
Yeah.
Like, yes. It just has this sort of like immense scope, kind of mythic quality to it. And, you know, each page contains discursions and diversions and, you know, lapses into like different, you know, kind of like mad, almost, you know, mythical or magical storytelling, you know, really ornate language. And so if you're the kind of reader that, you know, has no patience at all for something like Moby Dick or Blood Meridian, you're not going to like this book.
No.
But if you're enthralled by books like that, like we are and like many people are, this is that kind of book. It just has this sort of like, you know, it's like a strange combination between something like, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey or something, or maybe better, the Odyssey and like the Old Testament. You know, it has this sort of like that kind of a language combined with just, you know, fantastic or mythic kind of elements to it. And it's really quite an experience, you know, to read something like this. And then you add to that the fact that it's set on this obscure island off the coast of Tasmania at literally the bottom of the world, you know.
Yeah, this like hellish rock.
It's like otherworldly.
And there's like an immense, like, I don't know how else to say it, like magic to the storytelling in this book. As soon as you start reading it, I thought, I have the fiction writer in me or the novelist in me, so I have absolutely no idea how somebody sits down and crafts a book like this and just sustains it. It's like a 400-page book, and it's just sustained from floor to rafter. I just find that incredible.
It's really remarkable. Not everybody would have the patience for it, but this is one of the most remarkable books to come out of that part of the world, certainly in our lifetime.
No question about that. You know, I couldn't possibly do this episode without. And I said to you, John, I'm like, well, I'm much the idiot for letting this sit on my shelf for 15 years. You know.
Well, and the interesting thing. The interesting thing too, Jude, I don't know how much you looked into it. Like, you look at reviews and it was pretty divisive. There are some reviews out there, like the Guardian UK reviewed it and really trashed it, you know, thought it was just totally overblown and pretentious. You know, it was kind of a divisive book, but others called it like a masterpiece, you know? So books like that are always kind of interesting too. You know, that really divide people.
Yes.
And like, you know, some people are like, oh, you've got to read this. And some people are like, total waste of time. But you and I both know that there are many people that we know and love that would be like, I'm not touching Moby Dick with a 100-foot pole. That's like,
oh, yeah.
You couldn't pay me to read that book. But yet, you know, I think both you and I would call it the greatest novel that we've ever read. So, you know. Takes all kinds, but like it's probably a fitting note to sort of end on. I mean, this is really one of the most, I agree with you, I think it's one of the most incredible works of the imagination to come out of that part of the world, maybe ever. And you know, you talked about, you know, there's another really highly regarded great book out of Australia that you talked about called Cloud Street. And you know, they're both thick books set in that part of the world, but they couldn't, you know, I haven't read Cloud Street, but it's like just kind of a very human story about a family over time. This thing is like, I mean, that pig you mentioned is like, it's like, I don't remember how big it is, but it's like 30 feet high and like just eats soldiers for breakfast, you know?
Yeah.
Like it just has these fantastical or wild elements into it that don't seem to almost even correspond to the world that we live in. You know, so.
Yeah, but it's interesting you bring up Cloud Street, and I'll wrap up what I have to say about it coming back, because it sort of brings it around the beginning, because I did find myself thinking about Cloud Street. It's totally different, but first of all, they both happen to have this mythical pig. I don't know what happened there that played a role in the story that just kept coming in back and forth. into the story. But they also, but both books were epic in scope to me. They felt like epics, and they both had this magic I'm talking about. They're very, very different styles, different times, different. Everything's different about them, but they had this feel of a kind of a I guess I would just say, like I said with Julia Lee, like a phenomenal performance was taking place from the first page on, that the artist was just able to kind of sustain, and both books like really swept me up inside of them, and mm-hmm. that's the kind of thing that I wish I had some kind of formula to be able to do myself. I don't know how people do that, you know, just create kind of a book with an epic feel from the jump. That just kind of pulls you in, and you're like, it's the best kind of diversion from your life. It just takes you away into, particularly the Gold's Book of Fish. You know, you just go to some other bizarre plane of existence. But even yeah, Cloud Street did that for me. It swept me up in it.
Yeah, it's like something like 100 Years of Solitude, you know, by
yes.
Gabriel
yes.
Garcia Marquez, which just totally... You know, from, like you mentioned, from the jump, it just, the first couple sentences are just, you just sense the command that he has over the story he's telling, and you're just immersed in it the whole way.
And yeah, and another.
The language and the story and the characters and everything.
And there's another book by Marquez called The Autumn of the Patriarch about a dictator that has a similar feel. And I found myself thinking of that too. It has like these bizarre. Huge set pieces that just have this like magic to them. It's like nothing else I've ever read that I kind of remember the feeling of reading them also by yeah. Marquez. It's like that kind of book, you know?
Right. Right. Well, I really hope and think that listeners, you know, come away from this episode with a number of like really strong recommendations, even though there are so many great books from that part of the world. Just like, we'll say that with every one of these episodes that, you know, yeah. we barely scratch the surface. But if you can yes. come away with, you know, some solid recommendations to go and check out, we'll have done our job. So hopefully we have. I think we can kind of wrap things up here pretty quickly. We always talk about what we're going to read next. And in my case, I haven't decided yet. So I have a couple candidates that I'm thinking about, but I haven't really made that decision. And one of them, you know... is related to the next episode that we're going to do. So do you have something that earmarked? Well, I guess you're working on this trilogy you mentioned. So is there a third book that you're gearing up to read after reading Authority by Jeff Vandermeer?
Well, so readers listeners will be relieved to know that I remembered my pithy name for my trilogy. It's going to be a disappointment. It's called The Triple Deuce.
Triple deuce. Wow.
Meaning three books that are the second book. That's, you know, congratulations to me for remembering that. It's kind of a letdown. But anyway, I'm only on the first of the Triple Deuce Authority. And the second one I'm going to read is a book called Dune Messiah, which is the sequel to the classic science fiction novel Dune that came out in, I believe, the Dune Messiah, the sequel came out, I believe, towards the end of the 1960s. Anyway, really love the book Dune, love the film that came out from Denis Villeneuve recently, and then there's a Dune Part 2 coming out. Got my son into it. Your son's really into it. And I thought I'd go by. I've actually read Dune Messiah, but I read it probably when I was 18 or 19 years old. And I don't remember it, so that's next up for me, Dune Messiah by Frank Herbert, the epic continuation of the Dune cycle of novels that he wrote. So that's what's coming for me.
Gotta love that. You know, sci-fi classic there, the Dune series. Someday,
yeah,
it seems to come up in every episode we do, but someday we will get to our sci-fi episode. But,
yep.
Well, I'm gonna, you know, it's like... There's a couple seconds left on the clock, and, you know, somebody needs to drain the three-pointer from the top of the key, and that's where you're standing. So I'm going to pass you the ball and see if you can't drain it. But you're going to tease episode 56 for us, so I hope you're ready.
Yeah, I am ready. I'm very excited about it. This is going to be a great episode, John. I'm surprised we haven't done this already. It just so happens that we're coming around on the calendar to, you know, a holiday in the United States that's known as Father's Day. And in all seriousness, you know, fatherhood, I'll speak for myself, but I think I can speak for you also, is kind of the primary engine in our lives, in this period of our lives, just being fathers of four children each. And we also lost our father, you know, 8 or 9 years ago. And so every year at Father, you know, around Father's Day, we have the opportunity to think about fathers and what they mean and what our father meant to us, etc. So, but we haven't done this yet, so we're going to do an episode on fathers in literature. Not exactly sure what we're titling it yet, but we're doing an episode for fatherhood in which we talk about some of our favorite fathers from books that we remember from novels or nonfiction. And I can't wait to do it. What do you think about that?
No, I think it's going to be great. It's going to be a real change of pace from the last ones that we've done. And I think there are a lot of, you know, famous fathers or not, you know, famous or infamous fathers in great books across the ages. So I know I already have a pretty good list going. So I think that's going to go in a lot of interesting directions. So it just happens to align with the calendar, but I think it's going to be a really cool topic for us. So definitely looking forward to that one.
Certainly another topic of discourse between the two of us over the years, that's for sure.
That's right.
Being a father.
That's right. And as you say, we both have four children, so we're kind of neck deep in it, you know. so that should be. But most of us, I mean, not everybody, but most of us, you know, have had a father or a relationship with a father or have wondered what that's like. So I think there's a lot of rich fodder for that episode. And that brings us to the end. As usual, it's been a great discussion, Jude. Thanks a lot for taking part in it. And thank you all for listening to the Book Exchange Podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. It was great. We did our best. We hope you tune in for the fatherly episode next time.
There you have it, folks. Take care.
Bye-bye.